2007, speaking for the class with brother Paul Parry. The theme for the class is I am returned to Jerusalem with mercy. Today, subtitle is I will dwell in the midst of thee. The reading for this class has been Zechariah 1, verse 18, chapter 2, verse 22.
Thank you, Brother Chairman, and good morning, my dear brothers, sisters, and young people. Well, some 2 months had passed since Haggai's last words to the nation, and it was now time for Zechariah to take up the burden of the ministry and to give a series of night visions which were to stimulate and to strengthen and to encourage. As we saw in Ezra, they prospered to the prophesying of Haggai and Zechariah. So whatever these visions talk about, brothers and sisters, the effect was to give prosperity in spiritual themes. Though they deal with the future, though they deal with great issues, there are a number of issues specifically that the nation needed to understand at the time that they labored. You know, Zechariah is a very different prophecy to Haggai and to Ezekiel. Haggai is a very pragmatic kind of man. A man whose hands are in the dirt and his words are very clear, uncompromising about working and setting their heart upon their ways. Ezekiel is a prophet who deals in dimensions and measurements and angles and reality. But when we come to Zechariah, the visions are altogether different. Altogether different. They're more like the prophecies of Daniel. The symbols are more expansive. In fact, we're going to see through Zechariah that the Zechariah is more interested in the earth, more so than Judah, although Judah, of course, features in those prophecies. We spoke about the spiritual trauma of the captives. The priesthood has gone. The line of David has gone. The glory has gone. Forgiveness is gone. God has left the place. He no longer dwells in this place. Everything is gone. Would there ever be a restoration of all of these things? And it's these issues, brethren and sisters, that in fact Zechariah the prophet deals with. I am returned unto Zion, says chapter 8 and verse 3. I'm coming back. I'm coming back. And those are the words that Israel needed to hear, that God was still interested in them. The priesthood reconsecrated. We're going to see that in the visions in chapter 3 when Joshua is, as it were, reinvested as the high priest. The house of David. Once removed, I will overturn, overturn, overturn. It shall be no more. What would happen to the line of David? Well, God was interested in the line of David, but in a far different kind of way. Chapter 12 and chapter 13 of Zechariah indicate. The glory of the ark. There will be a different and superior type of glory in the house of God. The ark never came back. Omitted from all the lists of the furniture. But there will be a different manifestation, a superior manifestation of glory. Would God ever forgive them? Well, in the visions of chapter 3, there was a great indication that God would remove the iniquity of the people. What reassurance that was to them. Would God ever dwell again? Well, we're going to see in our study this morning that God would dwell again with them. I am returned to Jerusalem with mercies. The covenant. Would God ever remove the covenant? Well, there's now a new dimension in the covenant. There will be a king who would in fact shed his blood, the blood of the covenant. And the greatness of the covenant, the new covenant, would now be in operation soon. Could God's love and mercy ever return? It certainly could. And would God's rule come back? It certainly will. Now you see all those issues, brothers and sisters. All those issues are higher issues than working in the temple, though of course working in the house of God is important. But this is a reassurance. We need reassurance that God's with us consistently, and how much more this nation who've been absolutely devastated by war and destruction. They're in an identical situation. And Zechariah will deal with those issues. temple and tabernacle had significant pieces of furniture missing in the return. And so what Zechariah does, in actual fact, is take, I guess, the meaning of the tabernacle furniture, the symbolism of the tabernacle furniture, and presents it in a slightly different way. The literal piece of furniture may not have come back with the captives, but the intent and the desire and the symbol of that furniture was ever present. You take the altar, for example. Now, they did rebuild the altar and put it on its basis, and there's only a very slight reference to the altar right at the end of the book of Zechariah. The future altar of the future age is just mentioned in passing, because the altar was, in fact, re-established on its basis. The laver speaks of washing, cleanliness. Well, Zechariah says the laver never came back, the molten sea never came back, but God will provide a washing and a cleanliness that will clean all the uncleanness of the nation. Zechariah 13, verse 1, and a spring from chapter 14, verse 8. The lampstand. In Zechariah chapter 4, we're going to see a whole new perspective about the lampstand, a different way of viewing the light of the world. The showbread table never came back, but God says there will come a time when God will unite with all nations. There will be fellowship, not just in Israel amongst 12 loaves and 12 tribes, but across the whole world. The incense altar never came back, but God says, I will pour out grace and supplication upon Israel, when the prayers of that people will be accepted by God. The Ark and the glory never came back, but we're going to see in chapter 2 and chapter 6 that the glory of God is now in a far greater manifestation in a man, in the midst of Israel, not just in a piece of furniture. No longer is there a pillar of fire, there's a wall of fire. No longer is there a high priest, there is a great high priest. And the vessels that have been brought back will become holiness to God. So you see, all of those things, brothers and sisters, are mentioned. And finally, even the courts, the dimensions of the courts, are going to get mentioned in chapter 3. So whilst most of that furniture never ever came back, Zechariah is now building the symbols and the lessons of all of that represents into the figures of these particular visions in a most remarkable way. What about the line of Judah? The royal throne, the power and majesty, the rulership and dominion. I don't want to go through any of these quotations. I'm just going to list them up there. You can either write them furiously down or get them later. But can you see that Zechariah is now going to actually pick up all of these themes of a king, a throne, a crown, dominion, judgment, justice, truth, conquest, the weapons of war, the ensign, all of these things of reality of the rule of Judah that have been overturned and overturned and overturned. There's now promises of it coming back, but in a far greater, a far more effective way than ever, ever the line of David could give. Remarkable. Pity that's just off the screen a little bit. Is that just the... Okay, so it's my computer, not your data projector. That's okay. As long as you can see those words there. And the most dramatic change is the merging of the line of the priesthood and the line of the kingship. Prophet, priest, and king would all be merged into a single, unique individual, Messiah himself. That's the massive change, the greater change. And Zechariah's going to talk about that. So can you see, brothers and sisters, that the consolation that's being offered to these people to make them think higher than what they're doing as they're working amongst the dirt and the stones and the mortar and the timber, there's a greater, greater glory that they need to focus on. They're wonderful issues indeed. Now each vision, whilst looking at the future, is designed to encourage the generation who's listening to this. And there are a number of questions that would have come up from Judah. Will we ever find rest? Will we ever find rest? How long before God will have mercy upon us? We've gone 70 years. Brother Colin mentioned that this morning. 70 years we've gone. Will there ever, ever, ever be an end to this captivity? And what about God's love? In his anger, he thrust us away. Will he ever, ever love us again? And finally, the enemy that we find always upon us, that always distress us. Those are questions that would have gone across. And as you're laboring amongst your fellow people, your fellow brethren, all of these things are being spoken about. Will God ever remember us again? Now I'm going to do a hyper link across the first vision, because it really is the focus this morning on the second and third visions. But I just want to give you just an overview of this first vision. And it starts off in verse 8 with the very simple words, "Behold a man." Behold a man. Take a good look at this man. Where have you heard those words before? Behold the man. John chapter 19 and verse 5, then came Jesus forth wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. And Pilate said unto them, "Behold the man." But look at him now. No longer is he crowned with thorns. In chapter 1 and verse 8, he's sitting upon a red horse. He's no longer sitting upon a donkey, the foal of an ass. He's sitting on the war horse. And the horse is red, riding upon a red horse. A totally different picture. The crown of thorns have gone, replaced now by the red horse. And the significance of that is explained for us in verse 11. The horse and the horses that he had were a symbol of the means by which the earth has been subdued. The earth has been made quiet from this horse and the horses that are in this particular vision. This is the way in which the vision is in fact opened up. And whenever you look at horses and red, it is quite clear, brothers and sisters, that it symbolizes warfare. Job 39, the war horse, designed by the Creator to be able to go into battle. The red horse of Revelation chapter 6, verse 4, bloodshed. Revelation 14 and verse 20, the man on the red horse with the blood up to the bridles. The horse was covered in blood. Always a symbol of warfare, warfare, warfare. That's a startling way to commence the night visions. Who'd want a dream like that in the middle of the night? It came, brothers and sisters, by night, because it was very similar to the visions of Daniel, which also came by night. Warfare and bloodshed. But there was a hope there, because this horse, this man, stood among the myrtle trees in verse 8. They were in the bottom. The myrtle was in fact a tree used in the Feast of Tabernacles. Nehemiah 8:15 tells us that. And the Feast of Tabernacles, in that future age when the earth is quiet, will be a time of rejoicing. So the man has actually stood. The warfare has been accomplished. The earth is at peace and at rest. And the earth is now breaking forth into the rejoicing of the Feast of Tabernacles. So in a very, very quick picture there, we have this remarkable scene. It's interesting that, in fact, the man was amongst the myrtle trees at the bottom. There's some dispute as to the meaning of that Hebrew word, bottom. Some say it means shade. Some say it means a deep hollow. Most of them, in fact, go for this deep hollow, this deep depression, where myrtle trees tend to grow in the valleys and depressions of the earth. And, of course, in Revelation 17, verse 8, that's the very place where the nations come from, the bottomless pit, the abyss, the deep hollow, conquered. Conquered. But the point of this, when Zechariah saw those horses, it gave him an indication of the means by which the warfare would be accomplished. There were other red horses, great bloodshed. You know, we talk about the judgments of God upon the earth, which honor have all the saints. But if you think, brothers and sisters, that two-thirds of Israel will be decimated in Armageddon, think about the ratio of the destruction of the Gentiles throughout the world. It will at least be a similar ratio. So the population of the globe, and you work at that, two-thirds of that, that is great bloodshed indeed. An enormous judgment upon the world. I don't think we understand the enormity of that. Two-thirds at least of the world destroyed by the judgments of God. But also, brothers and sisters, the horses were speckled. The word, in fact, is tawny or bay. It comes from a Hebrew word to hiss, and that word is used of plague victims. The hissing of plague victims, an unusual way, isn't it, of expressing plague, but a person is gasping. That's the word used, the root word used for that horse. But in all of that, the warfare will actually be accomplished in righteousness. There will be a justice about this judgment. It's not indiscriminate. It will be achieved in righteousness. And the interpretation is given to us in verse 10. These are they whom Yahweh has sent to walk to and fro through the earth. In fact, the horse riders, who in fact are the saints themselves, respond by saying, we have walked to and fro throughout the earth, and behold, all the earth sitteth still and is at rest. The whole earth is at rest. What an amazing work we have ahead of us. Not just to judge the world, brothers and sisters, but to give it rest. To give it rest. In 2 Chronicles chapter 16, verse 9, a magnificent quotation. God says that the eyes of Yahweh run to and fro throughout the earth to show themselves strong on behalf of those whose heart is perfect towards God. And that quotation is a description of the angels. The eyes of God everywhere, running, racing, backwards and forwards across the earth. Not just to save, but to show themselves strong on behalf of those whose heart is perfect. And this group of people on these horses are now equal to that work. They are equal to the angels. They do the same work. They go to and fro throughout the earth. They replace the work of the angels, who no longer have jurisdiction over the future age. And the earth is at rest, because Isaiah 32 says, the effect of righteousness is peace and quiet and assurance forever. The work of righteousness. What a day that'll be. Having subdued the earth to transform it by righteousness. This world has no idea of the difference between right and wrong, good and evil, light and darkness. And it will be the responsibility of us, God willing, to go forth into that world and to show them the difference. Because hopefully we know the difference now. Now, immortality, brothers and sisters, isn't just some magical kind of infusion of qualities upon us that we've never had. It's not like that at all. It is the enhancement of a character that we have attempted to develop, a likeness to God that is enhanced. If we haven't got those qualities now, they're not suddenly given to us in the future. They have to be developed now. And immortality will enhance them to a superior level. But they've got to be there first. But you know, brothers and sisters, it's all very well receiving a vision of conquest, of assurance that one day the whole world will be at rest. But the Jewish people laboring in the dust and in the bricks and the mortar have got far more urgent questions to be answered. Yes, that's terrific. That's wonderful that the earth will be at rest. But what about now? What about now? And verse 12 says, O Yahweh of hosts, how long wilt thou not have mercy on Jerusalem? That's the question they wanted answered. That's the question they wanted answered. And we have, brothers and sisters, a series of angels discussing and talking about these things. And an angel responds in verse 13. Yahweh answered the angel that talked with me with good words and comfortable words. These are the words we want to hear, the good and the comfortable words. How long? I mean, those are the questions that we ask. How long? We're in the year 2007. How much longer can things go on? How long? And the generation of Zechariah's day asked exactly the same question. How long? It was almost mouthed in the mouth of the angel because the angel is anticipating the issue, anticipating the question. So in verse 14, the angel that communed with me said unto me, Cry thou, saying, Thus saith Yahweh of hosts, I am jealous for Jerusalem and for Zion with a great jealousy. You know, jealousy is an exceedingly powerful emotion. Exceedingly powerful emotion. When you feel that something is happening in the relationship between you and your wife and you become jealous, that's an exceedingly powerful emotion. In fact, in the Hebrew, it's a combination of zealous, jealous. It's an unusual word. But it's an intense feeling that God has for his people. This people has been violated. This people has been defiled. And God says now, I am jealous. There's an intense emotion here with a great jealousy. And the captives are listening to that. The exiles who've returned are listening to that and thinking that's comfortable words. I am jealous. And look at verse 14, it's not just a whisper. I'm jealous. Cry out. There's intense feeling here, brothers and sisters. This is how God feels for his people. I am jealous with a great jealousy. It's amplified in chapter 8 and verse 2, by the way. I am returned, says verse 16, with mercies, and my house shall be built in it. That's the answer to the question of verse 12. Not law, mercies. Not one mercy, multiple mercies. Now you imagine hearing those words, brothers and sisters, you would be overcome with emotion. After 70 years of desolation and death, despair, to hear those words, I'm coming back. Verse 17, my cities through prosperity or through goodness shall be yet spread abroad. That's an interesting word, isn't it? It's the word used of being dispersed in captivity. God says, I will give you another disbursement, but it'll be the cities. The cities will be dispersed through the land. And Yahweh shall again, as the Hebrew is, again comfort Zion and again choose Jerusalem. And you can imagine just the emotional feeling of that. God is back. He is back. You know, brothers and sisters, we have to, I think, appreciate the power of those words. It's all very well to have the world conquered, but what about now? And God is back. And that's what I have there on the chart, 2 Chronicles 6:16, which is the equivalent of the reading that we did this morning in 1 Kings chapter 8, is in fact a declaration by God right back at the very beginning that God would choose Jerusalem to put his name there. And those words spoken at the dedication of the first house are now echoed in this first vision in Zechariah chapter 1. Even though the house was still under construction, God says, I'm back already. You don't have to finish the house, as it were, but I'm back. What a wonderful thought. What a wonderful hope. What glorious words. I'm back. But there were other questions to be answered. And this is where we deal in more detail with our second vision. You notice that each vision actually starts with, take, for example, verse 18. I lifted up mine eyes and saw. And that's the way each of the visions are introduced. There's some dispute when you get to the end whether there are seven or whether there are eight visions. But that's beside the point. They're all introduced by this, I saw, or I looked up, or I lifted up mine eyes. But there were very real questions. It's all very well to have the earth conquered, but what about the nations now? Will they continue to distress us? The Samaritans, always putting the pressure on. The nations around us who are anti-Semitic. How will God deal with those? Well, the answer comes in verse 19 through to verse 22. Will there ever be another captivity? How will the enemy be defeated? And so the answer is given in the vision of the four horns. Four horns. That's an unusual expression, isn't it? What do you think the record spoke about a vision with four horns? They had just finished building the altar and putting it on its bases, and that altar has four horns. And we recall that the reason why they gave or built the altar was for fear of the nations that were round about them. Remember that from our previous studies? They were afraid of the nations, so they built the altar. And as they put the four horns on the altar, that was a symbol of something in connection with the response against fear of the nations. So God took that symbol of the four horns and he blended it into this vision. In actual fact, it's really, I guess, four horns that belong to animals because these animals are chased away. But the four horns was an immediate connection with the work that they had achieved in that altar. Now Zechariah says, what be these? And you'll find throughout the visions of Zechariah that Zechariah is always asking questions. It's a good habit to be in. They're not cynical questions, nothing worse than hearing cynicism, but they're genuine questions. And if you look at the prophets of old, particularly the Daniels of this world, the Johns, Zechariahs, they're always asking questions. What's this? Why this? Where are they going? What are they doing? Because it shows an interest in the Word of God. That's how you learn, how you develop. I've got 1,001 questions in my Bible study notes, probably about 2 or 3 answers. But it's the questions. Why? Why not this? How come that? Stimulates interest, stimulates us. Keeps the mind active, and Zechariah is no different. What be these? I mean, we know the answer because we've read the book, but as you see these four horns suddenly appear, you think, well, what are they? What are they doing here? Why this next vision? And the answer comes back in verse 19. These are the horns which have scattered Judah, Israel, and Jerusalem. Now that's interesting. Judah, Israel, and Jerusalem. And I think there are two patterns of fours here. The first group that scattered Israel, Judah, was Assyria, Egypt, Babylon, and Edom. All of those nations had a hand in the destruction of both Samaria and Jerusalem. But in the wider scheme of things, of course, it relates to the four empires of Daniel: Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. Scattered. So what's the answer? What's the answer? Is it a bulldozer? Is it fire and judgment? Is it intense heat or intense cold? The answer, brothers and sisters, is four craftsmen. Now what an unusual solution to that vision. As we have there, the word craftsman is the word harash, which means a metal or a wood fabricator. Not necessarily just in wood, but also in metal. A fabricator, a builder. Now, that is an unusual way to introduce the saints. Four, of course, we know to be a significant number as far as Israel is concerned, the fourth square encampment of Israel. In Ezra chapter 5, when the work first started, and he looked upon the Temple Mount, guess how many carpenters you could find working? Four. Haggai, Zechariah, Joshua, and Zerubbabel. They were the first respondees to the work. And they became a symbol of that which is right and good. The line of the high priest, the line of the king, and the word of the prophet. All together, four carpenters. These workmen are specifically known as the good figs. In fact, quotation is 2 Kings 24 and Jeremiah 24, off on the left there. These are people selected by God because of their goodness. They are the brethren of the carpenter himself, Jesus of Nazareth. But there's a very interesting quotation, actually, about the craftsmen in the scripture. I'd like you to come to 1 Chronicles chapter 4, as we have there on the overhead. 1 Chronicles chapter 4. Because there were a group of craftsmen that were specifically known in the genealogies of Israel. And of course we know that Ezra wrote or recorded those genealogies. Now look at 1 Chronicles chapter 4 and verse 13. And the sons of Kenaz, Othniel and Sariah, and the sons of Othniel, Hathath. I'm having trouble reading here without my glasses. We'll skip the next name because I can't read it. Actually, we'll do the right thing. No, when I can't read it, I can't even pronounce it. Menothai begat Ophrah, Sariah begat Joab, and the father of the valley of the... Now notice that Hebrew word there, Harashim, for they were craftsmen. Now that Hebrew word there, as you can see from our overhead, is in fact the plural word of the word craftsman. So there was a valley of carpenters nearby to Jerusalem. And the point is, brothers and sisters, that those craftsmen were very interesting people. Who was Othniel? Othniel was the first judge of Israel whose responsibility was to cast out the heathen. Isn't that interesting? And after his judgeship, he in fact settled down as a craftsman. And his descendants finally gather themselves together as a league of craftsmen in the Valley of the Craftsmen. And that would have been known to those people. So as soon as craftsmen come upon the scene, it's not just men building the temple that were known, but there were these people who were linked back to the very first judge who cast out the heathen. Isn't that interesting the way the records should present that? So let's come back to Zechariah, shall we? The four craftsmen. And what were they to do? Well, the record says there that in fact they were to, verse 21, I said, what come these to do? Now, you can almost see Zechariah scratching his head and thinking, there are these animals there with these horns, and all of a sudden four craftsmen appear with their hammers and swords. Zechariah is probably scratching his head and saying, well, he does in verse 21, what come these to do? It wasn't apparent what these craftsmen could do. You wouldn't normally bring out hammers and chisels to attack animals. But verse 21 says, these are the horns which have scattered Judah, so that no man did lift up his head, but these are come to fray them. To fray. So we have there on the screen, the Hebrew word means to startle and to terrify. Used of scaring birds away, of discomforting a host, of throwing the enemy to a state of alarm. These craftsmen are more than craftsmen, they're warrior craftsmen. They're soldiers. To cast out the horns of the Gentiles, that's what Othniel did. He cast out the Canaanites from the land. And these are no different. Notice at the end of verse 21, that in actual fact, these horns lifted up their horn singular over the land of Judah. And that's the kingdom of men, isn't it? It's a singular power, but there's a multiplicity of horns which it controls. We are those carpenters, God willing. We are those carpenters who will remove the enemy from the land. Startling, but consoling. I'd like to come to Zephaniah chapter 3, just a few pages back, because there is a wonderful quotation in Zephaniah that they may have been aware of. In Zephaniah chapter 3 and verse 15, we read that Yahweh hath taken away thy judgments. He hath cast out thine enemy. The King of Israel, even Yahweh, is in the midst of thee. Thou shalt not see evil anymore. Yahweh hath cast out the enemy. What a day that will be. No longer the enemy, but he sets their borders with violence. No longer the Russian host. No longer the anti-Semitism. Gone forever. What an amazing scene that is. And the King of Israel in the middle of that country. Astounding. We come to the third vision. And the questions continue and the answers continue. I mean, as you labored upon that site, brothers and sisters, and you put together this house block by block and brick by brick, and you cast your eye a bit further, the place was absolutely deserted. In fact, for many, many years later, the place was deserted because Nehemiah, many years later, had to take, in fact, a 10% levy of all the population and ask them to come into the city to populate it. The place was deserted. How depressing is that? This once bustling city is now absolutely empty. Will Jerusalem ever, ever be filled again? And the glory, as we said before, will the glory ever return? And what about the rest of the captives? There are 90% of those captives still in Babylon. Will they ever come back? My brethren, perhaps members of my family. Does God really care for us? Does he really care for us? And Babylon, that enemy that's been destroyed by Cyrus, it still exists. Still a powerful city, yes, under a different dominion, but will Babylon ever be punished? And how will God dwell with us again? See, all those questions, as you're building in the site, you're talking next to your neighbor, all these questions are coming backwards and forwards as you're laboring, hard work. So Zechariah's third vision is now going to address all of those questions. So I lifted up mine eyes in verse 1, and lo and behold, a man with a measuring line in his hand. Behold a man. Ring any bells? That's the same phrase in chapter 1, verse 8. Behold a man. Have a good look at him. And this time he's no longer on a red horse, but this time he has a measuring line in his hand. The last time the nation of Israel heard about a man with a measuring line in his hand was through the prophet Ezekiel. Remember that? The man with the measuring line, the reed, who went round the temple, taking the dimensions of the temple. So this would have immediately got their attention. The measuring angel is back. Of course, Zechariah is interested, isn't he? Verse 2, I said, whither goest thou? I mean, it's obvious what he was going to do, but where are you going? Where are you going? The answer comes back to measure Jerusalem to see what is the breadth thereof and what is the length thereof. Notice, not the height thereof. This isn't the measurement of a building. There's not three dimensions, it's two dimensions only. We're talking about geographic, two-dimensional measurement. The breadth and the length. Now, if I came to you with a measuring rod, a measuring line, and I decided to measure two dimensions, this way and that way, you'd be very soon to know how many meters, how many kilometers, in your country, how many miles, the dimensions I were measuring. But you know, that's absolutely absent from this measurement. The last time they saw the man with the measuring reed, they were the cubits, the royal cubits, and you know, knew precisely how it all intricately dovetailed together. In this measurement, there is no boundary. It's as though God is saying that there are no limits to the expansion of this city that I'm going to give. So in verse 3, behold, the angel talked with me, went forth, and neither the angel and another angel went out to meet him. Now, have you noticed in Zechariah that there are these angels talking and communicating with each other? We haven't really time to talk about this, but it's interesting to note that this fraternity of Elohim are intensely working and interested in the welfare of Israel. And this movement of angels talking and walking and answering questions and giving directions is an amazing concept. An absolute unanimity of people who think and act and walk in the same way. Now, brothers and sisters, that is the fraternity that we hope to be equal to in the future age. And whenever you come across the work of the angels, particularly in the work of Zechariah, they are absolutely united in their zeal and in their purpose and in their thoughts and words. So I want you to think of your ecclesial circumstances back home. Do you think, brothers and sisters, that God is going to give us, if we are persistently the kind of person that's divisive and argumentative and fractious, quick-tempered, do you think he's going to fit you into that fraternity of angels and hope you fit? I mean, that's why, brothers, we are developing the qualities of integrity and righteousness and uprightness and peace now. Because that's the fraternity that is dealing with all of these things. Brothers and sisters, we won't fit into that community if we don't have those qualities now. As I said before, immortality is not some magic change where we switch from being evil to being good. It's an enhancement of a character we've already developed. Could we fit in with that group, brothers and sisters? Ask yourself that question back in your ecclesial life, the way you deal with brothers and sisters, with each other. Can we honestly say we fit into that kind of environment? Because that's the environment of the angels. We'll speak a little bit more about that when we come to our next study in chapter 3, an amazing thing which the angels participate in the things of God. So this angel went and met me. And in verse 4 they said to him, run, speak to this young man, saying, Jerusalem shall be inhabited as towns without walls, for the multitude of men and cattle therein. Run! You know, we're not talking about a slovenly kind of walk or a shuffling along. This angel says to him, run! Run to Zechariah, to this young man, tell him, there's excitement here. Yeah, you know, I mean, can you imagine the response of the workers in the temple listening to that? The eyes of Yahweh run to and fro throughout the earth. 2 Chronicles 16, verse 9. Here's an example of that. The zeal here. This community is excited. Jerusalem shall be inhabited. Where did that come from? Well, as we have there, this I think is an amazing quotation in Isaiah 44. Funny we could read all the quotation. Now you read this quotation very carefully in Isaiah 44 with me. God says, and this is the prophecies of restoration in Isaiah, He confirmeth the word of his servant, which is the word of the prophet. He confirms that, Isaiah's words being confirmed. And he performeth the counsel of his malachim, his angels, that saith to Jerusalem, thou shalt be inhabited. Now the power of that verse is this, brothers and sisters, that we have these messengers, these malachim, running backwards and forwards, saying, thou shalt be inhabited. That's precisely what Isaiah 44 verse 26 said, that God confirmed that word, and the angel knows that. And the word of his angels and the word of the prophet are being executed in a wonderful way. Jerusalem shall be inhabited. Because Isaiah 44 verse 26 and Isaiah 44 verse 28 said, Jerusalem shall be inhabited. And to see that place full of people, prosperous and bustling again, is wonderful. Now notice verse 4 says that it in fact will be inhabited without walls for the multitude of men and cattle. In Haggai, the cattle had been decimated by disease. Now Zechariah says it'll be full, absolutely full, a city full of these people. And says verse 5, I will make them a wall of fire round about. Now this is an amazing shot. This isn't your back garden barbecue. This, in fact, was a pyrotechnic display they had somewhere in the USA, and they had a series of special fire explosions that were timed to all coincide. But it gives you an idea of a wall of fire. And that's power. That is power. In the wilderness, there was a single pillar of fire which led them into the way. God says, I'm going to come as a wall of fire. The angels of God are like flaming spirits. And that wall of fire needed the eye of faith to perceive. And when I saw that picture, I thought, wow, that is an amazing demonstration of the way in which God, in fact, has placed around that city a wall of fire, defensive. You can't get through that. It's because it's unlike that, all the way around the city. And I will be the glory in the midst of her. Fire and glory. Where do those two concepts meet together? Fire and glory. Well, here is the Ark of the Covenant. Back in Genesis, the cherubim were first associated with a flaming fire. But more specifically, when God dwelt in the midst of Israel in the glory, the Shekinah glory, there was an incident over here on the right-hand side when fire and glory were in fact combined together in the dedication of the house. So what God is saying to these people is whilst you're building that house, even before you finish it, I'm back with the fire and the glory. And what was experienced in the days of Solomon? What was experienced when the house was first dedicated? I'm telling you now, it's happening. The fire and the glory are back. Now, do you know, there's another quotation that talks about the fire and the glory. Here is Isaiah chapter 4 and verse 5. And I've changed the translation slightly to give you what the Hebrew really expresses, because the Hebrew works like this. And Yahweh will create over every dwelling place of Mount Zion and over her assemblies a cloud and a smoke by day. That's fire and glory. And the shining of the flaming fire by night, for over all the glory shall be a defense. Now there's fire and glory in the future age. Over everything is this canopy of glory. Over all this glory is God's defense. This city will be impregnable in the future age, this temple city. But what I find very wonderful about this quotation is that word defense in the Hebrew is a wedding canopy. In the Jewish weddings, they had a wedding canopy. And what that record is saying, brothers and sisters, is that when God establishes his temple in Israel, and the saints and the Son of God are there in immortal glory, over all that glory, over all that splendor, over all that tremendous power and energy is a wedding canopy, because immortality will be just like an everlasting honeymoon. Isn't that a wonderful concept? Power, energy, glory, and yet the feeling in that place is like a honeymoon forever. What a wonderful picture of the fire and the glory in the future age. They're great symbols, aren't they, brothers and sisters? Great symbols. But what about those other brethren in captivity? What about those other brethren who still are there, the 90%? And in fact, there were even more Jews in dispersion, because when the Assyrian came to take Samaria, they dispersed the Jewish people even further than Babylon, across the Assyrian Empire. And they began to trickle across into the western part of Europe, across the coastlands, where they formed their synagogues eventually for the first century proclamation of the truth. What about these brethren? Well, verse 6, we read of these. Ho, come forth and flee from the land of the north, saith Yahweh. For I have spread you abroad in the four winds of the heaven, saith Yahweh. The city of God will dwell without walls, because God will be a wall of fire. But what about those in far-off lands? The land of the north. Embedded in this prophecy is an implication of further dispersion. It's a mixed message, brothers and sisters. Notice that, you see, I have spread you abroad as the four winds of the heaven. When the Babylonian captivity had taken place, they only went one direction, eastward. Zechariah says they will return, but it will be from a far greater dispersion of captivity. And that would have set them back in their tracks a little bit. The land of the north. Going to skip those slides. The land of the north. If you draw a line north of Israel, you end up pretty close to Moscow. The land of the north, Europe, Moscow, there is a far greater captivity coming. Now this links with the previous vision, because the horns scattered Judah, Israel, and Jerusalem. And so chapter 2 and verse 6 is saying that the scattering is going to the four winds, but there are two places particularly where I'm going to bring my people back. The first is the land of the north in verse 6, the second is the daughter of Babylon in verse 7. A far greater captivity. Do you think that the people who rule Russia, having seen their army wiped out by an unknown force in Armageddon in Israel, is going to willingly give up its Jewish population? The very fact that Zechariah had to say to those people way up there in Russia, and there are still Jews in Russia today and in Europe, get out of that country, is indicative of the fact that that country, those powers, will refuse to let the Jewish people go. But the power that really is mentioned is the daughter of Babylon. Not Babylon, the daughter of Babylon. Do you think the Roman Catholic system, Babylon the Great, is going to give up its Jewish inhabitants? within Europe, in the countries of Catholic influence. Did you know that just recently, Benedict XVI, the current Pope, recently reintroduced the Latin Mass? He's a traditionalist, you see. Vatican II Council, there was a liberal council, had no problems in dismissing the Latin Mass. Don't understand what you're talking about. We want the Mass in our own language. Benedict has reversed that. Mystery is coming back in. I mean, how many people speak fluent Latin today? Only priests. But you know, that part of that Latin Mass, there's a little clause there that caused great unrest amongst the Jewish people. Because that Latin Mass has a clause in there that prays for the conversion of the Jewish people to Catholicism. They have been anti-Semitic since the beginning of their history. They have fomented pogroms, crusader attacks. They resisted the formation of the Jewish state in 1948. They polled, or they politicked against the establishment of the Jewish state. That's how much they hate Israel. Do you think they'll let the Jewish people go? Deliver thyself. Get out. Get out. We'll come back to this, including their address this morning. Get out. They're not going to let go. But it means, brothers and sisters, that the Jewish people have to receive a messenger to tell them to get out. So we read on. In verse 8, thus saith Yahweh of hosts, after the glory, so once the glory of God has been established in the earth through his Son, after the glory hath he, God, sent me unto the nations which spoiled you. Now who's the me of that verse? There can only be two answers. One is either Zechariah, or two, it is a messenger styled in Revelation 14 verse 7, the angel with the mid-heaven proclamation. Now that reference is probably only relevant to those of you who appreciate the apocalypse in its detail. But there is a messenger which will be sent out from Zion after the glory has been established and the nations around them are ripe for judgment. There will be a messenger going out which in the words of Revelation 14 will say, fear God, keep his commandments, and submit yourself to his will. Elijah will be in charge of that. We perhaps, brothers and sisters, may involve, in fact be part of that messenger. Imagine if part of our task, part of our responsibility was to go out to the nations, of rolling up to the parliaments of this world and demanding a special session of parliament. Who are you? Where do you come from? Who do you represent? I'm an ambassador of Jesus Christ, the King of Jerusalem. King of who? Jerusalem. And I demand that the Jewish people come back and to visit the various synagogues and to talk to the Jewish people and to convince them that the Messiah has in fact arrived back in the earth and they need to come home. What a work that will be, brothers and sisters. Can you imagine yourself being there? He hath sent me. That me will go out and spread that message. Come back. Come back. Deliver thyself, O Zion. Imagine going through the Italian communities, the German communities, the South American communities, the Catholic communities, and saying, your Messiah has returned. Come back. What an amazing thing, brothers and sisters. What an amazing thing. After the glory hath he sent me unto the nations which spoiled you, for he that toucheth you toucheth the apple of his eye. That word apple is the only occurrence, it means the pupil. So when Russia invades, it's like a person putting their fingertip on the pupil, the most sensitive part of the eye. Ah! That's how I feel. And because all nations will be involved in Armageddon, messengers will go to all nations because they touch the pupil of God's eye, a sensitive part of that. What an amazing work that will be. So again, there's a mixture of sadness and yet hope, a greater dispersion, yet a greater deliverance. Verse 10, sing and rejoice, O daughter of Zion. For lo, I come. Where have you heard those words before, brothers and sisters? I come. The book of Revelation finishes with those words. Behold, I come suddenly, and my reward is with me. This is the Messiah. He's coming back. And I will dwell in the midst of thee. Sing and rejoice. Do we have any idea, brothers and sisters, of the emotion that we will feel when the Lord Jesus Christ is in our midst? Sing and rejoice. Isaiah chapter 12 and verse 6. Sing and rejoice, for the Holy One of Israel is in the midst of thee. At last, at long last, he's back. And we even know the words of the song we're going to sing. Revelation chapter 5 verses 9 and 10. Thou hast loved us, washed us, made us unto our God kings and priests. Can you see yourself there singing that song? I'm coming, says that verse. I'm coming back. And I will dwell in the midst of thee, and there'll be a singing and rejoicing, Benson, which will eclipse anything that we can do today. And we have a startling verse in verse 11. And many nations shall be joined to Yahweh in that day. Now we've just talked, brothers and sisters, about the judgments upon the world. And now Zechariah turns around and says, the byproduct of that is that many nations will be joined to Yahweh in that day. And the Hebrew word is the word used of the unity between a husband and wife. A uniting and binding and twisting and twining together. Israel, the nations, Christ and the saints, all twisted together like a rope with all its different strands, united as husband and wife. And those nations that you despise, those nations that are oppressing you at the moment, they shall be my people. And that language, brothers and sisters, is the language of the covenant. I will be your God and you shall be my people. And that language is now applied to Gentiles. They're now in covenant relationship. They shall be my people. And Yahweh shall inherit Judah and his portion in the Holy Land, and shall choose Jerusalem again. And we know that right at the center of the land will be this special holy oblation, specifically the portion of Judah, the center of the world, the most beautiful spot in the earth, both spiritually and physically. Isaiah 60 talks about God making the place of the soles of his feet glorious. You know, there are some beautiful spots in the world today. I guess Canada comes in one of them. But you multiply that tenfold, and you put that beauty in the land of Judah, the place of the soles of my feet, and when God says, I will make it glorious, you imagine the greatness of that place. An inheritance, a choosing again. This land that had been desolate, now the holy place of God. I've chosen Jerusalem again. And the vision finishes. The vision finishes with absolute silence. Remember we spoke about Isaiah 41. Remember the courtroom scene? Keep silence before me, O islands. The silence is back. In the first vision, the saints had gone through the earth and all the earth was at rest. Well, here it is again. The end of the vision. You know, I find that verse very intriguing. In our today's world, today's crazy world of 24-hour news, talkback shows, talking heads, world opinions, commentaries on this, commentaries on that, email, instantaneous communication. And for once, brothers and sisters, for once in the world's history, all flesh is going to be absolutely silent. Absolutely silent. Flesh, with all its arrogance, pride, hypocrisy, silence at last. For God is raised up out of his holy habitation. He's a man who's arisen, ready for action, ready to take control, ready for his work to be accomplished. I'm going to leave you with just a suggestion. Unfortunately, the quotes are off the left a little bit. All those things we've seen so far in our visions, get out of Babylon, the silence of the world, the horses of warfare, the man with the measuring line, God dwelling in the city, the glory coming back, the wall of salvation, and all nations at last at one with God, is the picture, brethren and sisters, of the last few chapters of the book of the Apocalypse. It's an amazing picture as John picks up all of these threads, and the world is absolutely silent. Babylon the Great has been thrown in the midst of the sea, and all of the noise of Babylon finished. And a singing and rejoicing fills the earth as the city comes from heaven, the wall established, and the nations are at one with God. All of this can be our future. Do you feel encouraged by that, brothers and sisters? I feel encouraged by that. The laborers in the temple would have been encouraged by that. As they look beyond the dirt and the dust and the difficulty and the sweat and the tears, and they look at the time when God could involve them in greater things. We await the day when we can sing and rejoice because our Lord is dwelling in the midst of us.